It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the sixth, much to my surprise, annual Henry Charles Lea Lecture. Didn't know they'd go on so long. 2009 will be the centenary of Lee's death, and it might be possible to squeeze in another one next spring, but we don't know. But we have one today. Lee is mostly known, when you mention his name, as the historian of the various inquisitions and witchcraft. But he wrote on a number of other subjects that tend to get laid by the wayside. Auricular confession and indulgences, for example, subjects that were barely considered history, even in Europe, and clerical celibacy. And we're going to commemorate that side of Mr. Lea today, or perhaps clerical non-celibacy, I guess. Our speaker is particularly welcome, a former colleague of ours here, Professor Ruth Mazo Karras, Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. The longest commuting professor I know. Puts me to shame. She is the author of a number of books, Common Women, Prostitution and Sexuality in Medieval England in 1996, From Boys to Men, Formations of Masculine Identity in Medieval Europe in 2003, and Sexuality in the Middle Ages, Doing Unto Others in 2005. It's a field in which you can get good titles. That always helps in scholarship. Her topic today is A Scandal to the Whole Clergy, Priests and Their Partners. A scandal indeed, madam.
Well, I want to thank Ed and his colleagues here at Penn for inviting me. I don't think I've been at all previous five, but I've been at several of them, and I'm very honored to be in their company. I also want to thank my many friends here from the Delaware Valley Medieval Association, from other colleges in the area. When I tell people that I'm working on a book on couples who live together without being married in the Middle Ages, most non-medievalists and many medievalists also immediately reply, "Oh, priests." And the idea, I mean, as Ed just mentioned, that the idea that some churchmen kept their vows of celibacy in the technical sense of being unmarried, but not in the more common parlance of abstaining from sexual activity, will not surprise you. The fact that the word celibacy takes on these two different meanings, the unmarried state and sexual abstinence, reflects the fact that the vast majority of Christian thinkers across denominations and right up to the 21st century have held that marriage is the only proper venue for sexual relations, and therefore that anyone who is celibate in the sense of unmarried should also be celibate in the sense of abstinent. But exclusion from marriage and exclusion from sexual activity are not the same thing. For one thing, you can exclude people from marriage by legislation. Marriage is a legal relationship, and if you simply define the union as not being marriage, as the church did with clerical marriage in the 12th century, then the clergy aren't married, they're celibate. But the result was not to prevent them from having sexual relations with women in an era that understood any woman who had sex outside of marriage as a whore. The result was to devalue a sizable group of women. But the treatment of the couples involved, and particularly of the women, varied considerably across the span of the Middle Ages. Now, Henry Charles Lea introduced his historical sketch of sacerdotal celibacy, and by the way, it's a sketch that goes more than 600 pages, by noting that, quote, "ecclesiastical celibacy has exerted influence directly and indirectly on the progress of civilization," end quote, and also that, quote, "the effect upon society of the policy of the church as respects the relation of the sexes," end quote, "could provide," quote, "an occasional glimpse into the interior life of past ages," end quote. And scholarship in the last several decades, notably that of Joanne McNamara and R.I. Moore, has demonstrated the significant effect on high politics of the imposition of a system in which a great deal of power is claimed by a group which perpetuates itself in a way other than dynastically. But I want to look today at the other side, what Lea called the habits, morals, and modes of thought, particularly with regard to gender and the status of women in the Middle Ages, that are illuminated by clerical celibacy, both attitudes towards women and practice. The enforcement of celibacy in the late 11th and early 12th centuries, why it may have been occasioned by the church's need to wrest property away from dynastic control was presented and couched in terms that blamed women for sin and corruption. By the late 15th and early 16th century, however, violations of clerical celibacy were no longer framed as impurity as much as disorder. Women were not so much polluting as weak and easily exploited. Both the enforcement of clerical chastity, as I'll discuss with a case study from late 15th century Paris, and arguments about the necessity of clerical celibacy during the 15th, 16th century reform movements revolved around the maintenance of proper social hierarchy. But social order depends on appearance. Being seen to behave properly and set a good example is more important than the state of one's soul in some ways. So, why do violations of clerical celibacy matter? There are two ways that medieval people and the historians who write about them have looked at a rule of celibacy that's frequently broken. One is to see it, the Protestant point of view, I guess, that sees it as a misguided rule, which takes a natural pair bonding and criminalizes it, with the consequence that people live as domestic partners without the name of marriage, one partner lacks a legal right to support, and the children are illegitimate. And I will leave the modern parallels to your imagination. That's a different paper, but I think they're pretty clear. The second way of looking at clerical celibacy is to stress the debauchery of the clergy who were not able to adhere to the high and pure ideals of celibacy and chastity, which were good in and of themselves. But just these few rotten apples corrupted the young women, not to mention young men of their flock. And in the era of confessional historiography, it was, of course, the Catholic writers who blamed the low moral character of certain individuals, but not the system. There were Protestant writers who accepted chastity as an ideal, and Lee called clerical sexual activity laxity and the perversity of a sinful generation. So he didn't just say that it was a bad idea in the first place, clerical celibacy a bad idea in the first place. But they blamed the church as hypocritical for tolerating concubinage while allowing marriage. And they were right that concubinage wasn't just the same thing by another name, because the illicit unions that were formed were more transient than the marriages of lay people, and the offspring weren't recognized and weren't supposed to inherit property, and therefore concubinage was seen as based more on sexual desire alone than on a wish to form a domestic unit and a family. In other words, if clerical unions are outlawed, then only outlaws will have clerical unions. Today we can measure with public opinion polls the extent to which same-sex unions are accepted within communities and see that it's rising, but that there remains a spectrum of opinion. I think if we could measure medieval opinion on clerical unions, we'd probably find a rather similar spectrum of opinion. Priests and their partners commonly did live together and were accepted by many in the communities in which they lived. Nevertheless, the church's repeated calls for reform left these couples open to harassment and punishment, often instigated by an officious neighbor with whom the local church officials were happy to collaborate. So I'll talk about the example of Paris in a few minutes, but this seemed to be demonstrated from a number of other jurisdictions. But because I want to argue that something had changed by the later Middle Ages, I want to look first at the moment when the church made its first major concerted attempt to enforce clerical celibacy. The Christian churches from the beginning treated clerical celibacy as an ideal, but although it was required in the Western church, in theory, of those in major orders since the 4th century, through the early Middle Ages it was only sporadically enforced by local efforts, and if a priest and his partner disobeyed and married anyway, the marriage was valid. But the efforts to enforce clerical celibacy intensified in the 11th century. In 1022, the Synod of Pavia, which was not legislating for all of Europe, but just for its region, declared that the wives and children of the clergy could be enslaved. The laity were encouraged to boycott masses that were performed by married priests, but the sacraments that were performed by such priests were still valid. If you went to mass, it counted. The First Lateran Council in 1123, this time legislating for the whole Western Church, required the separation of priests from their wives, and ordered married or concubinary priests deprived of their benefices. And finally, the Second Lateran Council in 1139 declared, this type of coupling which is contracted against the church's rule, we deem not to be marriage. Henceforth, all women involved in unions with men in holy orders of subdeacon or above were concubines and not wives. And this position was reinforced in subsequent centuries by the decretalists and by repeated decrees of synods across the various regions of Europe. Now, the scholarly consensus about the reasons for this new push for clerical celibacy is that it had to do with the ritual purity that separated the clergy from the laity. This concern for purity was not entirely new, but it was newly prominent. Politically, the church was asserting its independence from or its superiority to lay authority, and doing that required a morally superior clergy. And in a crasser economic sense, this independence from lay authority also required that the clergy not have dependents and heirs who might cause property to go out of the hands of the church. Theologically, an increasing emphasis on the Eucharist elevated the priest's role and required him to be in an appropriate state to handle the body of God. So the reasons for setting the clergy apart were multiple, and recent scholarship perhaps has stressed the property element more than theological element. But the important point here is that both the property element and the theological element were couched in the rhetoric of purity and separation. Now, it's not a foregone conclusion that abstinence from sexual intercourse would be the key to making the clergy pure. Both Christianity and Judaism have put a great deal of emphasis on abstention from sex, at least at particular times, in understandings of ritual purity, but not exclusively so. In Leviticus, a priest was defiled by handling a dead body. But the reform movement of the 11th century did not focus on keeping priests away from corpses. The shedding of blood, which is permitted to the laity under some circumstances, made a cleric impure. But it didn't excite the same sort of concern among the reformers as did sexual activity. The existence or proximity of weapons didn't pose the same kind of threat as the existence or proximity of women. Gregory VII did object to simony, the process of buying and selling ecclesiastical offices, as much as, if not more than, he objected to clerical unchastity. But women provided a more convenient and convincing scapegoat than did corpses, blood, or cash. Unlike the selling of offices, which was a wrongful use of money and of church office, it was not just the wrongful use of the female body that reformers found objectionable. The female body itself was polluting. The attitude of many church reformers to sexual activity on the part of the married laity was ambivalent, although the central trend in high medieval theology would be towards considering reproduction a good thing. When it came to the clergy, who should be temples of God, vessels of the Lord, and sanctuaries of the Holy Spirit, in the words of the Second Lateran Council, marriage as well as fornication was sinful and forbidden. All women with a connection with priests were concubines or whores, and in fact there's even, in terms of 11th and 12th century understandings of masculinity, there's an attempt to couch lay men who have to do with women as effeminate, and the clergy who live in an all-male world as the new man. The best-known rant against clerical sexual activity is by Peter Damian, who in writing to Pope Nicholas II in 1059 said that priests with wives make themselves one flesh with a whore. Addressing priests, he said, at the imposition of your hand, the Holy Spirit descends, and with it, your hand, you touch the genitals of whores. In a 1064 letter to Bishop Cunibertus of Turin, he objurgated priests' wives in the strongest of terms, and I'm not going to read this. I don't believe in reading your PowerPoints. Put this up here so I don't have to read it, but Damian was extreme in his polemic. But he was widely read and influential in his day, and he wasn't the only person who uses this kind of language. Humbert of Silva Candida's Contra Nicetam has something of the same tone to a lesser degree, suggesting that a Greek who supports clerical marriage is based not in a monastery but in a brothel, and quote, wants to make the Church of God a synagogue of Satan and a whorehouse of Balaam and Jezebel, end quote. So the cascade of imagery that Peter Damian gives us here is overwhelming, but the main theme is transgression, pollution, uncleanliness, not greed for church property, and not disorder. It's worth noting that the impurity has to do with blood, poison, and demons, and doesn't have anything to do with excretion. Not that kind of impurity. Now, Peter Damian is also notorious for attacking sodomy, which I'm not going to talk about here, but for the most part, in Damian and others, the deep suspicion of sex translated into a deep suspicion of women whose sexualized bodies represented a constant temptation and threat. The women here, it became a battleground for struggles among men about whether kings or churchmen should dominate, whether bishops or monks should control the church. But nevertheless, it was real women whose liaisons were demoted to concubinage and who were stripped of any property and inheritance rights they may have had. Now, the defense of clerical marriage, because there were people defending it against Damian and others who attacked it, focused on the practical argument. It is better to marry than to burn. If the clergy cannot remain chaste, it's better for them to marry than have concubines. This was the main thrust of the 11th century pamphlet attributed to Ulrich Augsburg, which circulated throughout the Middle Ages and into the Reformation, as well as other high medieval treatises such as the Norman Anonymous. Now, the defenders of marriage weren't defending women. They focused on the cleric's needs, not on women's moral virtue, not on the value of family life. And these texts used Pauline passages, which would be the focus of later discussions as well. All these passages appear in the Reformation fairly prominently. But the defenders of marriage lost. By the 13th century, legislation had been successful in establishing that these women were not wives, although not successful in preventing priests from living with them, as we know from local examples from visitation records. In terms of the gender system, the 11th and 12th century abjection of sexually active women was part of the attempt by the church to wrest political power from the great dynasties in which women had an important role. As such, of course, it was hotly contested. And if the views of Peter Damian are only dubiously characteristic of the church, they can hardly be said to be characteristic of society as a whole. But we can say that the late medieval reformers represent part of a trend that would develop further in the all-male spaces of the medieval monastery and university to use women to think with in a negative way, representing sin. As Caroline Bynum, most famously, but others as well, have shown, this negative discourse equating women with flesh and sin was not universal. But the existence of an important counter-discourse of woman as positive symbol of the flesh, as Bynum discusses, doesn't mean that the negative valence wasn't there. The popular story that reappears in texts for priests to use in their sermons from the 13th century on, of the dove that swoops down and grabs the Eucharist out of the hand of a priest who has a lover, gives a vivid symbolic expression to the idea that Damian articulated that the hand that touches a woman should not touch the sacrament. Now, by the late Middle Ages, the basis of the discussion shifted from purity to social order. Separation between the clergy and the laity, to the extent it had ever existed in practice, had broken down. The clergy, I mean, the 12th century ideal was that all of the clergy should behave like monks. This ideal wasn't being stressed so much anymore by the 15th century because there was a sense in which many monks were not behaving like monks either. By the end of the Middle Ages and into the Reformation era, the church's treatment of clerical celibacy, both theoretically and in practice, was essentially about how to keep up the appearance of the greater holiness of churchmen, to set a good example by not leading a disordered life. And as the discourse shifted to the social rather than the spiritual consequences of celibacy or marriage, discussions tended to treat the women involved as people existing in society rather than merely as good to think with. But they were still viewed as a threat, not to priestly purity, but to hierarchy. When people in the late Middle Ages objected to the family life of their clergy, the basis seems often to have been resentment rather than theology. People worried not about the priests being polluted and therefore invalidating the sacrament, but rather that the priests were encroaching on what lay people saw as their own privilege of having a family. Recent studies of clerical masculinity in the later Middle Ages underscore this resentment of clergy who wanted to have the advantages of clerical status without its disadvantages. If they wanted to be respected as fathers of their parishioners, they could not be fathers of a family. But this resentment rested on whether their public behavior distinguished them from the laity, not on whether the state of their souls distinguished them from the laity. By the 15th century, a few voices called once again for priests to be able to marry. Wycliffeites in England and Hussites in Bohemia, who also denied the sharp separation between laity and clergy in other ways, as well as some Orthodox writers, denied the necessity of clerical celibacy. Discussions at the Council of Constance, 1414 to 18, and Basel, 1431 to 45, focused mainly on suppressing concubinage rather than allowing marriage. But at Constance, some leaders spoke against clerical celibacy on the grounds of its previous failure. The lawyer Guillaume Seignet wrote a treatise for the Council of Constance in which he suggested that nature did not permit celibacy. This didn't mean that sexual license was appropriate, but marriage should be allowed to all because it's the natural way. Clerics commit the sin of fornication not because all sexual activity is sinful, but because the church misguidedly prohibits the natural and reproductive coupling of marriage. Quote, they want to call themselves more than perfect and call themselves chaste, but wrap themselves in the veil of hypocrisy, end quote. Responding to the purity argument, Seignet says that marriage is a sacrament and therefore not impure. The 15th century reforming tract Reformatio Sigismundi also complained of the hypocrisy of the marriage prohibition. Bishops prosecute priests with concubines just to get money. It would be better to allow priests to marry, since otherwise they seduce the wives and daughters of other men or become sodomites. And this argument about unmarried priests turning to sodomy is not new. The Lollards used it also, and they weren't the first. But it's worth noting the emphasis on social order here too. Priests should marry so that they don't disrupt other men's control over their households or other men's control over their own bodies. The debate about clerical marriage, framed in terms of social order, would continue during the 16th century reformations, both in the German-speaking lands and in England. In neither place was a priest's marriage in the 16th century simply a personal choice. For a priest in Germany and England to get married was a statement about belief in church reform, a form of the lesser evil argument that abstinence is good, but that marriage is better than fornication for those who cannot abstain, meshed well with the Protestant idea that all humans are sinners who can't be saved by their own works, but only by God's grace. So the choice for the 16th century reformers is not between sexual activity and a precarious chastity, but between marriage and the procreation of legitimate children and other forms of sexual activity. But the Protestant argument was not about taking behavior that priests were going to engage in anyway and blessing it as marriage. Rather, castigating concubinage implied that there was a distinction between two kinds of women. Protestants wrote that the Catholic priests had their partners, but those were whores, whereas the Reformed clergy married respectable women. The English Bible translator William Tyndale wrote that the clerical celibacy rule showed the church's hatred of women because it degraded them, so that churchmen would associate only with the worst of them. Quote, O poor women, how ye despise them, the viler, the better welcome unto you. A whore had ye liver than an honest wife, end quote. To be the wife of a Reformed priest in the early years might lead to similar material disadvantages as being a priest concubine, possibly greater opprobrium than a clerical concubine in the later Middle Ages, at least in places where the secular authorities didn't support the reform. But at least some of the women who married Protestant clergy did so out of religious commitment. Marjorie Plummer suggests that in Germany in the early years of the Reformation, up to 2/3 of clerical wives were former concubines, but this is far from true of all. And by the late 1520s, many families were pushing their daughters towards marriages with clerics in order to support the reform. Now, the marriage of the clergy in the Reformation era had social implications not just for the clerics themselves and the women they married, but also for their flock. It's better to marry than to have your neighbor burn, claim the reformers. If priests don't marry and instead fornicate, they lead others astray with bad examples. Johann Eberlin, a German Franciscan who became active in Luther's reform, put in the mouth of his unreformed priest in a dialogue that perhaps some lay people in secret sin will be less God-fearing, seeing that I have honor and wealth in public sin. So both traditionalists and reformers could agree that public concubinage made the church look bad. The question was how best to avoid it, by eradicating it, making it less public, or replacing it with marriage. A concubinary clergy, reformers argue, didn't just model a disregard for the law that would lead to social disorder if it spread to the laity. It also created that disorder. Fear of the clergy appropriating women who are under the control of other men permeates Reformation arguments in favor of clerical marriage. George Joy, an English Lutheran, wrote in the 1530s that priests, quote, keep other men's wives, their children to sit by other men's fires, and as themselves live by other men's labors, so make they other men to cover their whores and whelps under the only names of husband and father, end quote. The point of clerical marriage, thus, is not saving the cleric himself or the body of Christians for whom he should set an example from greater sin, but rather protecting the laity from the practical consequences of the cleric's choices. This characterization of clerics as likely to cuckold other men is hardly new to the reformers. It's a common medieval topos, but what's new was its deployment as an argument against clerical celibacy rather than just an attack on clerics. Even the defenders of clerical celibacy in the Reformation era made their arguments in terms that took much more account of the society around them than did the 11th and 12th century reformers. The issue was still about the separation of the clergy from the laity, but not because of the holiness of the priest's sacramental role. Rather, a cleric who wasn't better than a layperson couldn't take his proper place in the moral hierarchy as a leader. In his response to Luther in 1521, Jerome Emser wrote that allowing priests to marry would allow everyone else to slip out of their obligations as well. If priests should be allowed to marry because of human frailty, then shouldn't wives also be allowed to cheat on their husbands because of human frailty, and young men to steal money from their fathers to give to whores? Theological arguments still played a role, but without a belief in transubstantiation, the argument that purity was required to handle the Eucharist lost some of its force. Similarly, with Luther's priesthood of all believers, the idea that priests needed to be more pure than others or bound by a different law made less sense, although they were still supposed to be moral leaders and good examples. But to say that changes in attitudes towards clerical celibacy were driven by theological change obscures the social context and gender implications which are undeniably present. Robert Barnes argued, again, an English reformer, argued that the pollution of touching female flesh did not apply to wives, quote, for the Pope reckoneth it filthy and not seemly that a priest should with his holy hands touch a woman's body and with the same hands consecrate the holy sacrament. What abominable holiness of hypocrisy is this, to reckon a priest impure and unclean because he has used himself in God's holy ordinance? Why be not your hands defiled for handling of whore's flesh? Is whore's flesh so clean that priests may handle it, and the flesh of an honest and a good woman so unclean that priests must be burned for handling it? Barnes was not here denying transubstantiation. He did that elsewhere. But he's denying the relevance of celibacy to it. A good woman subject to a husband is not a source of impurity. Well, so both Protestant and Catholic reformers saw lay marriage, and Protestants also saw clerical marriage, as a mainstay of the social order. Ideas about nature that developed over the course of the later Middle Ages led to an emphasis on sexual activity and reproduction as part of God's ordered creation. The emphasis on marriage as a positive alternative to perpetual virginity didn't change suddenly with the Reformation, but was part of a new emphasis in the 15th century on the family under masculine stewardship. Those who argued for and those who argued against clerical marriage did so on the basis of the way clerical behavior was visible as a model to the laity. And I want to talk now about the way in which this happens well before the Reformation. Oh, sorry, that slide should have been there earlier. This is where I'm going now. The church courts of Paris provide a concrete example of the way clerical unions were understood in terms of the social and gender order of the later Middle Ages. The richness of church court records as a source of information needs to be balanced against the fact that they're hostile sources. Penalties brought in a not inconsiderable income to local church authorities, who also had an interest in maintaining the reputation of the church. Although clerical sexual activity is quite common in the registers I'm going to talk about, they don't allow us to quantify it. Well, you're going to see I am going to quantify what's in the records, but the relation of that to what's actually going on is not entirely clear. From the people who reported on the clergy's sexual activities, who testified as witnesses, or who were accused of defaming priests, however, we can learn something about how priests and their partners were regarded by the communities in which they lived. A close look at the criminal registers of the Archdeacon of Paris which exists in an unbroken series from 1483 to 1505, will help give us a sense of how priests and their sexual partners were treated, and to some extent how they were viewed. The records contain a variety of cases besides sexual and matrimonial offenses. Many of them involve various kinds of misbehavior by priests, celebrating mass in places where they were not licensed to do so, wearing inappropriate clothing, gambling, violence, misappropriation of church funds. There's actually there's a huge volume of cases on violence, which are really interesting, and there's a good dissertation in there for somebody. And the I have all the registers in digital photograph form, so if I can't sell it to any of my students, anybody who would like to work on it is welcome. So there are a total over this 22-year period of 1,617 cases involving sexual or matrimonial offenses. 296 of them involve priests. These are the categories that they fall into. Most cases of paternity, of carnal knowledge, which in other jurisdictions would be called fornication, but they don't use the term fornication here, or frequenting, which means, can mean visiting, can mean hanging out with. I think it's occasionally being used as a lesser offense when people won't confess to carnal knowledge. They'll confess to visiting that person and not having sex with them. These cases don't, as far as we can tell, involve long-term unions, but occasionally there will be a case of carnal knowledge in which the priest is said to be living with the woman, usually in his house. And I'm not going to throw more detailed numbers at you, but I do have them if anyone wants them. There are very few adultery cases in this set of registers, largely because adultery is reserved to the bishop's court. We don't have bishop's court records from this 22-year period. We do have them for about 100 years earlier, and there aren't any adultery cases there either, so go figure. There are a number of cases in which married women are involved without the term adultery being used, and this is one of them. And I'm going to comment on some other interesting aspects of this later, but this is a priest who pays a fine for scandal caused by the rumor that he is maintaining in adultery this married woman. So many of the adultery cases are probably failed marriages. The couple are no longer together, but they can't divorce. There are actually a number of separation cases here, which are quite interesting, where the church court will allow the couple to separate. They'll divide up their goods, and they'll allow them to cease living together. Usually, they will not. Retain the marriage debt. The couple have to continue having sexual intercourse with each other if one of them wants to, but they don't have to go on living together. The case that's most likely, the type of case that's most likely to be a quasi-marital union, are the cases that are labeled maintaining or concubinage. And the ones that have, where I've got two categories here, where it's where the people are fined for both. Maintaining often, but, and it's hard to tell. I have not been able to find a pattern in which cases get called maintenance and which cases get called concubinage. The couple, in both of these, the couple aren't always living together. One of the few women fined for being maintained or kept, Isabelle d'Esponville, who is called Domichella or Demoiselle, so it may mean that she's from an elite family, although most of the people from higher levels of society, I think, end up in the bishop's court, not in the archdeacon's court here. It says she stayed and kept herself and always spent the night with Master Isambert Falvar for a period of 18 months. And so the Latin statisse continuisse tenuisse semper pernoctasse. So the scribe here seems to have been particularly concerned to emphasize that the couple were living together. They stayed and kept herself and spent the night and. Implying that this wouldn't always be the case. Jean Sivard, a priest living in the parish of St. Paul, paid a fine for maintaining Jacqueline La Puissant in his house as though she were his wife, drinking, eating, and spending the night knowing her carnally and committing adultery. And this phrase, as though she were his wife, is not a usual phrase, but it's not unique. You find it in a number of cases, and that's a pretty good indication that this is a domestic partnership. Now, concubinage probably does mean the parties were living together, but it's not always stated here either. The longest duration of union given is 20 years, the shortest a month, with the median a year. And there are cases of maintenance that also go for as long as 20 years. In view of the way priest partners were blamed in the central Middle Ages, in the 11th and 12th century, where it's the woman who has all this opprobrium heaped on her, it's interesting to note that more priests were fined for having concubines than women fined for living in concubinage with the priest. And this is also true of laymen. The men are more often fined than women. The case of Richard Lucas and his concubine Antoinette shows how a concubine may have thought of herself as entitled to certain rights, if not legally, at least morally. According to the prosecutor, Antoinette had been Lucas' concubine for 18 years. However, he had been discovered by some of his parishioners in the stable of his house alone with Jeanne, the wife of Simon, a local tailor. Then Antoinette burst into the stable yelling, and the words are given in French in the record, "Hey priest, wretched as you are, go ride your she-ass, am I not good enough for you?" Now the result of the case doesn't survive, but cases like this indicate that a concubine had an expectation of fidelity, and when the priest violated that, she could get as upset as a wife. So a scattering of cases in which priests lived in long-term relationships with women doesn't tell us much about attitudes, but the fact that a number of these couples who were brought into court and punished had gone for years without incident before being punished indicates not only that enforcement was less than rigorous, which is certainly true, but that many couples' behavior really didn't bother their neighbors and their community. The community certainly didn't hesitate to bring sexual misbehavior to the attention of authorities when they found it problematic. Richard Lucas' parishioners confronted him when he was cheating on his concubine, and with a married woman at that. But for 18 years prior, they apparently had not. At least the records usually say if the person had been brought into court before. And it doesn't in this case. Now, the number of people fined for the offense of scandal, and that number, 61, is for people who are fined for scandal alone and not for scandal plus another offense, so it's even more. Tells us something about what it is that the church courts and the community were objecting to. Sometimes a scandal could be a lesser offense to confess to, and that's what's going on here with Guillaume Pahé. He confesses to scandal caused by the rumor of adultery, not to the adultery. That's what it means here. Although he does not do it, that's referring to the adultery. So he makes amends, that is, he pays a fine for the scandal caused by rumors of his adultery, although he does not commit the adultery. The asterisk here is just, there's an asterisk in the text that with the marginal note of where the rumor is circulating, that's down at the bottom. This is the medieval equivalent of an asterisk, and the note's down at the bottom. Even without being convicted of the sexual offense, as in this case, you could be fined for making the whole church look bad. When Mathieu Bourderel was accused of creating a scandal to the whole clergy, scandalum totius clergy, with his carnal knowledge and maintaining of a woman named Jeannette, it meant that he shamed them all by the public nature of his offense. One maintaining case caused scandal because the woman remained in the priest's lodging even when he wasn't there, an indication that they were living together, at least on a temporary basis, but also perhaps that this wasn't the community's expectation. They expected that he'd be maintaining her somewhere else. Another priest was accused of causing scandal by keeping a woman as his own wife, this phrase again. Another denied that he had carnal knowledge of the woman who lived with him or that he called her his wife, but he admitted that someone else might have thought she was his wife and therefore it created a scandal. So the court was particularly concerned about disruption of the ecclesiastical order by priests not just having sex with women, but denying the church's authority by living with them and treating them as wives. It undermined the church's authority and brought it into public disrepute. And in cases where the priest didn't actually deny the sexual offense, but paid a fine both for it and for the scandal, the fact of scandal made the offense worse. Now, other priestly acts besides sexual intercourse were also considered scandalous. Bringing women into the parish house, the domo presbyteralis, eating a meal with prostitutes, committing acts of defamation and violence, and in one really interesting case, being deloused by a young girl, Juvencula, in the public square. Eating and drinking, and this was a priest who did a lot of other scandalous things too, but this is one of the things that he was accused of. Eating and drinking with women was a recurrent issue. It was not a sexual offense per se, but looked bad to the neighbors. Being alone with a woman, especially in a bedchamber, looked very suspicious too. Now, we don't know the stories behind these cases. Often what we just have is this person came into court and paid a fine for thus and such. Obviously, not all priests who came into any sort of contact with women were prosecuted, just as not all priests with concubines were. Accusations of scandal cover a very wide range of individual circumstances. But the point is that in all these circumstances, making the church look bad was an available and plausible offense to allege. And it's not just that the church authorities feared the priests would make the church look bad. Many of these cases of scandal were brought to the court's attention by the community itself, taking it upon themselves to police the behavior of the clergy and indicating that they were scandalized. Nicolas Paul, the vicar of SPA, was fined for scandal because, quote, certain companions went to his vicarage and placed a ladder against the wall, and through the window they saw a certain woman of ill fame, which created a scandal, whom he immediately escorted out of the house through the back door. Well, you know, he wasn't exactly misbehaving publicly, but the neighbors had some suspicions because otherwise why are they bringing the ladder to his house in the first place? Once they confirmed the woman's presence, it became a scandal, even though he evidently wasn't caught in the act and he wasn't fined for carnal knowledge or for frequenting the woman. 5 years again, the same Nicolas Paul was fined for scandal in that a certain Catherine came repeatedly to his room, although he swore he did not actually know her carnally. And that's, again, the same as what happened here with Guillaume Pahé. The reason why I have this manuscript here, why I want you to see the manuscript in particular for this one, is that it says he maintains in concubinage, manu tenuit in concubinato, and then concubinage is crossed out, and they've written adulterio in here. So clearly they are distinguishing whether it's concubinage or adultery that's going on. It matters enough for the scribe to cross it out and write the correct thing in, even though he's denying everything and confessing only the scandal. The neighbors apparently also suspected that something was going on when Gervaise Cahier, vicar of Montsou, went to the home of Pierre Prévost, a stonemason, to sleep with Pierre's wife. When Gervaise removed his tunic, some servants who were in the house beat him. Now, in this case, Gervaise was not cited to appear in court, but did so of his own accord. What this probably means, the civil registers survive for part of the period that these criminal ecclesiastical registers survive. And you can see that when people appear of their own accord in the criminal register, it's often because they brought a case that's recorded in the civil register and they had to confess to a criminal offense in order to make their civil case. It doesn't survive for the year in which Gervaise paid his fine, but he probably brought a suit against Prévost's servants for the beating, and therefore he had to confess to the circumstances of the beating, but he paid 8 sous, which is a fairly large amount, for the scandal that he caused. So we see here there's a lack of community tolerance of clerical sexual activity when it involves prostitutes or when, as in Gervaise's case or in Guillaume Pahé's case, it involves married women. Priests who lived in stable domestic partnerships and didn't cheat on their concubines don't seem to have bothered the neighbors as much. So the language of the cases indicates that it's publicity that was often the problem. Guillaume Delacroix brought Jean Labourdière to his house, quote, with many people seeing, unquote, and was fined for scandal. Jean Chevalier was fined for frequenting and having carnal knowledge of a certain Jeannette, because of which lampoons, libelli famosi, were posted, naming her La Chevalier, so the feminized form of his name. It was reasonably common for women to use a feminized form of their husband's name, and so lampoons using the feminine form of the priest's name were intended to publicize and satirize the relationship. In this case, the priest was also fined for the sexual intercourse as well as scandal, but the court's care in noting the scandalous result of his indiscretion indicates the concern with appearance and order and not just morality. Other scandalous cases came to the court's attention because of violent and loud behavior. They underscore the notion that long-term relationships were acceptable as long as they were discreet. When loud quarrels made the union impossible to discreetly ignore, it would be prosecuted. A woman named Marguerite came to the priest Jean Lepel's house and pounded on the door crying. And again, the words are given in French. Pretty often when somebody is quoted directly, especially when it's a case of defamation, or when it's a case of scandal, the words are often given in French. So she yelled, "Open up, wimp, I want my gown," to which he responded, "I will not open up, here, have a gown," and tossed one out the window. In the case of Georges called Tastevine and his concubine Pierrette, the scandal, again, was the fact that they quarreled publicly. After many words between them, she pulled out his testicles, or pulled them so that blood flowed. And so he then is fined for scandal because of this. Jean Testu, a priest, paid a fine for doing the thing, rim fuckera, which is a occasional but not common euphemism, with a certain Guillemette who frequented his chamber for a period of 4 or 5 years, such that the said Guillemette repeatedly slept, dormit, with him in his own bed, sometimes in another bed, since the said Guillemette had a bed in his said chamber, which belonged to her. Which is, I think, an indication that she has moved in with all her furniture. Testu also was fined for creating a scandal, in that Guillemette loudly and publicly called him a bawd and said that he kept her in his room for 2 years without letting her leave. This could have been a situation of imprisonment and exploitation, but I think it's more likely a domestic partnership gone awry, creating a bad appearance and reputation. It was the quarrel that brought the sexual relationship to the court's attention, and she then goes and makes these claims. Publicity didn't have to come from brawling and yelling. It could also come from participating in everyday acts. Master Jean de Paris, curate, paid a fine for having fathered a child with Jean Labourdière 20 years previously, when she had lived with him for 2 or 3 years in the parish house prior to her marriage. And he also paid a fine for the scandal that had brought the case to the attention of the court. What actually brought it to their attention? Well, he gave the daughter of their relationship in marriage, paid her dowry, everything for her to get married. And so that made it public. You had to go to declare, you had to go to the Châtelet and declare the dowry before two notaries. The chaplain of Le Plessis-Gassot was fined because 6 years earlier, a scandal had occurred when he had gotten a woman pregnant and she had brought the child to his door proclaiming that it was his. He didn't deny paternity, but he wasn't fined for the paternity. He was fined for the scandal, the public nature of his misdeed. The fact that he wasn't cited to court until 6 years later probably means that the promotor, the prosecutor, didn't find out about what was public knowledge until somebody came upset with him for some other reason and complained about it. Priests lived in their communities like everyone else. There may have been a good deal of resentment at priestly sexual activity, particularly when it involved married women, which led to the activity being reported. But in a number of cases, the relationship went on for a good long time without being fined. People knew about it and let it go or looked the other way. Where the priest was a well-liked member of the community and didn't quarrel over other issues, people might not be eager to go out of their way to get him prosecuted for his sex life. On the other hand, it only took one resentful parishioner to get him into trouble. Clerical sexual activity in late 15th century Paris, as elsewhere in medieval Europe then, was at the same time tolerated and not tolerated. If either partner were not on good terms with the parish, the union could be treated as disruptive and the woman deprived of her means of support. The parish records show that the church did not focus on punishing women as a way of maintaining the reputation of the clergy, but the women could end up as collateral damage if the court determined that the union existed or even that rumors of it created a scandal and threatened the social order. Research by other scholars on the treatment of clerical concubinage by episcopal visitations in the Crown of Aragon in Italy, from my own work on London as well, reveals a similar pattern of a combination of toleration and non-toleration, again with the woman not demonized. And the 16th century maybe looks a little bit different when you see it against this background, that these issues about should concubinage be tolerated, should we allow priests to marry, would they be involved with a better class of woman if we allow them to be married, look a little bit different if they're seen against the background of common practice in the late Middle Ages. Now, just how different is it from the 12th century? The system of church courts hadn't been elaborated by that point. No comparable records survive as far as documents of practice. So we can wonder whether the language of impurity ever found its way into enforcement on the local level at all. I think it likely that it did, that it found its way into sermons. The many collections of exempla, not from the 12th century, but starting from the 13th, with the theme of the priest concubine as polluting and demonic, indicate that although the battle against priestly concubinage was a losing one, it was fought on the basis of impurity well into the 13th and into the 14th century. But the terms of discussion shifted over the course of the Middle Ages, and the patterns of enforcement in this court and others, possibly slightly different in England, corresponded well with the new frame that would last into the 16th century, where it's behavior rather than the state of the soul that becomes a main focus of concern. I mean, I wouldn't say that the state of the soul doesn't matter for people either in the 15th or in the 16th century, but the concern with behavior is really what's paramount. Women did not bear the brunt of the enforcement, such as it was, of clerical celibacy in late medieval Paris. Being a potential creator of disorder might or might not put a woman in a better position than the 12th century woman who was a fleshly temptation or a threat to purity. But the idea of a church freed from the pernicious pollution of women no longer took center stage in discussions of celibacy. As priests and their partners continued in the later Middle Ages to live alongside their neighbors in a state of tolerance that could continue only so long as they lived an orderly life and didn't cross anyone, the rhetoric of impurity had given way in theory and practice to the discourse of example and appearance. Thank you. Questions, comments? Yeah.
Well, your study is obviously concerning the Church of Rome. You don't
yes.
touch at all on the Eastern churches.
No, I don't. And the situation there is obviously quite different. Although it's not entirely different because some of the same, priests can marry, bishops can't be married, and some of the same arguments about the polluting nature of women are made about Episcopal marriage, but I can't trace the timeline. I mean, I haven't done the work to be able to trace the timeline of attitudes in the Eastern Church the way I can in the Western. And obviously, this is also only not concerned with Eastern Rite Catholics either, who could marry. It is only the Roman Church. Did you have a comment about the Eastern Church that you wanted to make?
I would have thought that someplace along the line, somebody would have said, look, there's nothing wrong. The Eastern churches have proper relationships and still can divide it. I know that in the Armenian case, in the early days, you had to be married to pass on the priesthood to a son. ladder, so to speak. At some point, his wife went into a nunnery, and his son took over the priesthood, and he moved up to bishop and archbishop and so forth. And I'm just wondering why, in your researches, somebody doesn't say, hey, maybe there's another way.
Well, they talk about some of these, one of the bits that I quoted was from a dialogue against a Greek, and it wasn't a real Greek. I mean, this is a fictionalized dialogue, but the Western Church was certainly aware that Greeks allow priests to marry, and they didn't like it very much. They thought this was just one of the many things on the list of the errors of the Greeks that they talk about. And I actually don't know whether the Protestant reformers said very much about the Eastern churches as an example. Emmett probably knows.
They brought up the Eastern churches. There was a rumor that priests married in Spain, forced by their neighbors, and some mention of Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. But
it's not really prominent, though, is it?
No,
yeah.
No,
okay. Question back here. Yeah.
Can you comment on when your analysis of the cases specifically in church courts? Can you comment on whether you know anything about the fairness of those cases, whether there are external commentaries on whether the cases and the lawyers in these cases against Greeks are fair and just and open? And if not, and also whether any of these
as far as the fairness, it's very, very difficult to tell. I mean, there are extensive treatises about the church courts and the procedural safeguards that are in place. And it was, the system was certainly set up with protections for justice. There's not enough information on particular cases. There are some cases, not mostly these with priest concubines, but there's some cases in these registers where we're given extensive interrogatories, and you can see the he said, she said, and you can see that witnesses are sworn and give testimony under oath, and the oath, of course, in the Middle Ages is taken very seriously as because people really believe that if they commit perjury, they're damned. So there are procedures in place, but I can't tell you whether in a particular case the verdict was true or not. Most of these cases are not ones that were contested. Most of the cases in the register say so-and-so came into court and paid a fine for thus and such. So they're confessing to it. How much pressure they were under, we don't know. Certainly not all the cases of people having sex outside of marriage appear in this register, or there would be a lot more cases. Why these were singled out and not others, was it fair? I can't say. Tell me again the second question.
I was very short of myself. Were any of these cases tried in civil courts rather than?
No. I mean, I said civil register, but this is confusing. When the church courts refer to criminal and civil jurisdictions within the church courts, and that just means whether they're cases that are brought by one of the parties or cases that are brought by a prosecutor. Okay. You mean the courts of the town or of the kingdom or something like that, and not the church courts. For Paris, we don't have any of the secular courts for this time period. It may be that some adultery cases are being prosecuted there, and that's why they're not here. But they don't survive, so we don't know. One place where we have both church court and some civic courts is for London, both in the 14th and the 15th century. And there, yes, in fact, practically the only sexual offenses that are prosecuted in the civic courts in London are priests who are involved in sexual relationships. And pretty clearly, the municipality is using this as a stick with which to beat the church. So you do find that in some places, but I can't tell you for Paris because the records don't survive. Yes?
Yeah. I need to ask you just one question about the history of circumvention of a scandal or the scandal, the word scandal used in the context of your presentation. Mm-hmm. For the members of the clergy, priesthood, monks, and nuns, the question begins here. How do you live together with someone in a love and sexual relationship with the maintenance of celibacy?
Okay. I'm not sure I quite understand what you're asking.
How do you live together with someone in a love and sexual relationship with the maintenance of celibacy to avoid circumvent the scandal the way you presented it in your presentation?
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. Under what circumstances are people not being prosecuted for scandal? In other words, when is it not bothering people, and how is it going unnoticed?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I'm suggesting here is that the times when people are being prosecuted for scandal are either when they do something really egregious so that people have to sit up and take notice, like an affair with a married woman, or like the loud quarrels and bloodshed between the couple and so on, I'm essentially conjecturing, but I think that the times when it gets prosecuted are when somebody complained about it, probably because they had some other kind of grudge against the priest, and that the local community was probably just willing to tolerate it in many cases. I'm making argument from silence here, I guess, but these cannot, these cases cannot have been all the cases in which priests did engage in sexual activity, or even the cases in which they lived together. And the fact that there are some cases in which they lived together for many, many years before it was prosecuted indicates that, if it didn't bother anyone, the prosecutors in this court were not going out of their way to look for it. With the maintenance of celibacy in the sense of being unmarried, I mean, they're not considered married. If you mean celibacy in the sense of chastity, well, I mean, some of them claim to be, to have. A woman living in their quarters with them, but they were not engaged in a sexual relationship. I'm a little bit skeptical about that. Okay, Rita.
I think your argument is so interesting that the canon law is actually pragmatically flexible. And that is, it has this depth ability, more or less, to move with the times and to worry more about, as you summed up, behavior, the reinforcement of behavior at a community level, rather than kind of larger idealistic sense. It strikes me, as I was listening to you talk, that the literature of anti-clerical satire, which often stresses things like the clergy betraying, violating the vows of celibacy, is much more conservative in the focus of its satire. That is, that it doesn't seem to move with the times. I mean, it treats things as a kind of jolly scandal, like the Chaucer will treat this kind of stuff as a jolly scandal. But nevertheless, it seems to be coming out of a much more, it seems to be motivated by much more conservative issues, by much more conservative concerns. And I wonder to what extent there is perhaps more parallel between the between literary consciousness and the consciousness of literary satire and the deaf movement of the church in responding to behavior on an occasional basis rather than a kind of universal, you know, idealistic basis. Is the literature just kind of lying behind and just keep, you know, returning to these idealistic questions?
No, I mean, I had a section on literature that I had to cut out for reasons of time. But, you know, one thing, I mean, the literature, while you're right, I mean, that it does tend to keep on with these sort of purity ideas, and the Lollards dredge some of them up again, but it's also, I mean, I would say that Chaucer is pretty concerned with the social behavior of the clergy that he depicts. But interestingly, I mean, the summoner is the guy who is going out and finding the people who are committing the sexual offenses and bringing them into court, and Chaucer is not real thrilled with him either. You'll probably disagree. I mean, I think part of it is a certain conservatism that you see these same types cropping up over and over again in literature.
I don't.
Yeah.
Disagree.
Oh, okay.
That the literary culture remains strangely conservative, the legal culture is moving with the times.
I would say the Reevesstead is very relaxed. The Miller of Plumpington is married to the daughter of a local priest. Yeah. Very, very relaxed about that. My question is, I wonder if your research casts any light onto the structure of the household of the priests, because the modern flag of convenience for women involved in priests is to be the housekeeper.
Right.
And that also generates scandal about proof is very difficult. So is there a kind of an equivalent role to housekeeper in your period, or what exactly is the household?
You know, that's really interesting, because I would have expected to have found a lot more of that in Paris than I did. There are maybe one, possibly two cases in which the priest says, no, she was just my servant or just my housekeeper, I wasn't having sex with her. There are repeated, I mean, many of the cases, well, I have the figures, how many, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but many of the cases where the priest pays a fine for having sex with somebody, it's said to be his servant. So they were housekeepers in actual fact, but it wasn't used as a excuse or a way of masking the fact that they were in a relationship. And I'm surprised that it's so rarely used as a way of hiding that. Yeah.
Given the sexual aspect of scandal, and given the reality of priests' lives, right, as under your concept of open, does your research include homosexual relationships and ecclesiastical cases involving accusation of homosexual scandal?
Well, that's a really, really good question, and I mean, it's kind of the strange behavior of the dog in the night. That is, my 1,600 plus cases of sexual offenses from Paris and thousands of total cases, because there are a lot of others that aren't sexual offenses, there is not a one. And possibly that's because it wouldn't be in this court because it was too serious and is reserved to the bishop, but in the 14th century in the bishop's court, there aren't any there either. The accusations are very, very rare in church courts. And the places where you do find a significant number of accusations, such as
in Florence, as Michael Rocky's work has talked about, in some of the German towns. It's not usually in the church courts. There are very, very few sodomy cases in the church courts. And in the large number of cases from late medieval London, there's one defamation case where somebody's being accused of calling somebody else a sodomite. But there's no cases of people actually accused of being a sodomite. And this is very, very strange. And
I guess that I remember from some view that there was, I think it's Leo X, the cardinal petition for Leo X to engage in sodomy only in the summer months.
I'm not sure.
And I thought, well, if that could be that prominent within the legal construct, there would be some cases of charges.
The accusations of the clergy as being sodomites do crop up. I mean, certainly the Lollards make that accusation, and it comes up fairly frequently. But why else would they be trying to prevent them from being married, right? But it is not in the courts. Anne?
In the early church, or the late antique and early medieval church, there seems to have been a system by which men and women lived together without having sex, or at least there's a literature against that.
Right.
And do these courts ever cite that literature?
No. Well, they don't, these courts don't cite. Yeah, they don't. I mean, the only thing they ever cite is the decrees of the local synod. They don't even cite canon law or the canonists, and they certainly don't cite patristics. So, I don't know of examples of the practice of synesactism being really prominent in discussions in the late Middle Ages. Well, let's get somebody who hasn't. Yeah.
I was wondering if there are any cases of scandal in which people were claiming to be a priest's child, perhaps asking for inheritance rights or something like that, or is it only with the women themselves and not so much the potential offspring?
Illegitimate children have no inheritance rights. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't. The one thing that you could come forward and claim was a maintenance payment, alimentum. I mean, enough to enough to food and clothe the child until the age of majority. But it's the woman who claims it rather than the child. But it's usually claimed, on behalf of an infant. But no, there are no cases where people are claiming to want to inherit from the priest, but there wouldn't be, because that's the one thing that you can do. The law is not very effective at getting people to stop having sex, but it is pretty effective at not at controlling inheritance, because inheritance is a legal matter. Yeah.
These cases seem to have come about where somebody comes to the court, either the person who's paying the fine comes to the court, or somebody has a complaint that brings it about. You briefly mentioned visitation records that also point to the same issue. What happens when somebody is visiting and finds that the priest is living in somebody's house? What's the procedure at that point, and what kind of records are available from those visits?
Well, visitation records are really spotty. I mean, I mentioned a couple of places where people have done studies based on them, Daniel Bornstein for the Cortona region, and Marie Kelleher for the Crown of Aragon. And the bishop or his representative will conduct the visitation, and if the priest has a concubine, they'll generally order them to stop living together. And
sometimes they'll order the concubine to be sent away to another town in order to make sure that they won't. The coverage of visitation records is fairly spotty. There are both for France and for England. I mean, there's some, and they follow the same sort of pattern, but there isn't a concentration of them where I can really make a comparison with the church court records. Jessica.
I don't know if you actually, this is another part of your research that we didn't hear about, but I'm interested for the question of the fines and whether if you compare the same crimes for the priests versus non-priests, whether there's a difference in the fine structure or whether the scandals, involve lower fine rates of people that plead guilty to scandal in order to avoid getting fined for more major offenses or whether there is no systematic regularity.
The problem is that the fines are most often not given. Where they are given, there's a huge range, and it seems to be, the range doesn't really seem to be correlated very well with what the offenses are. So I think it has to do with how much the person can afford to pay, because sometimes it'll give a low fine and it'll say quia pauper, because he or she is poor. And the ones that have the highest fines are things are particularly egregious. Like there was one case in which a man had kept a concubine for 20 years and was accused of having attempted to bring about his wife's death so he could marry the concubine. She's not called a concubine, marry the woman he was involved with, and the way he went about encompassing his wife's death was to go to make a pilgrimage to Compostela to pray for it. he was fined a very very 20 ecudor. So I mean that's a huge fine, but usually I have not been able to find a clear correlation between fines and offenses. And the scandal is usually a lesser fine than scandal plus a sexual offense, but the number of cases where the amount of the fine is given, I'm not sure, is really enough to make that a statistically significant finding.
We're running a little late, and we have a very nice reception in here, so I think we'll thank Professor Kairos again.